Hello!
Hello!
Welcome to Lights Up on the Dark, the podcast where we explore the hows, whys, ifs, whats and whens of what it means to represent the Holocaust on stage. You'll have heard a very different voice saying hello just now. No, Alex hasn't got major vocal fry. She isn't able to record this week. Something about working full time, being on tour, not enough hours in a day, bills to pay, something. So while it feels very strange to me to not have her here, it has given us a brilliant opportunity to have a guest co-host for this week's episode. You'll have already heard me talk about him in previous episodes, so I can now promise and prove that he does exist. I'm delighted to welcome, zooming in from Scotland, guest co-host, Mr. John Summers Campbell.
Hello, I'm zooming in from London, and I'm going to get this completely wrong.
Okay.
So as our co-host, Samantha
Mitchka.
Mitchka, like I see, I just got it wrong. AKA Dr. Sam, Dr. Wonderful, Dr. Knowledge of Absolutely Everything. That is what I call her.
Oh, John, I love you. Welcome to the pod. It's so good to have you here. Finally, I know Alex is so disappointed that she couldn't join us. And I said, oh, it's okay if you can't record, you know, I'll get John on. And she was like, but. And I was like, look, if I promise not to terrify him away, we'll see if we can get him on for a later episode and we'll have
listen, I am a huge fan. So I have listened to absolutely every single episode. When you were saying you were going to be doing this, I was like on cloud nine. So it's a complete honour. And yes, Alex, I will be back.
Yay! So, well, you say you've listened to every episode. So you will have heard the episode where we had Mr. Stephen Unwin join us.
Yeah.
So rather than me attempting to do the incredibly awkward bit of trying to summarize you and your work to your face, would you mind doing your own This Is Your Life? I can't do the theme music, but
yes, I will. So my name is John. I'm currently in the Scottish Highlands in a little village called Kinlochbervie in the northwest of Scotland. I am a head teacher of a 3-18 school, and I love my job. It's an incredible opportunity to see the kind of young people that are going to be the future adults of tomorrow and to educate them and to help them along their journey. But before I became an educator, I was an actor, theatre director and Holocaust educator. My background was musical theatre, so so lots of kind of tap dancing, jazz hands, show tunes, etc. But then when I got into directing, I've worked with the National Theatre of Scotland. I had my own theatre company, Random Act Theatre Company. I have worked at the Royal Lyceum in Edinburgh. So I've done quite a lot. But my passion has always been kind of education. I moved into drama teaching. And then I moved into actor training as well, and then came back into drama teaching in a high school. I suppose along all those lines has been a connection to the Holocaust and a connection to educating people about the Holocaust, not just through drama, but Holocaust as its own subject area. So not related to history or RMPS, but getting young people to see it as its own subject. And it's been a real privilege of mine and a real honour actually, to work with some incredible fellow Holocaust educators, but also survivors, as well as different organisations. So I was the first teacher in Scotland to be recognised for my work in this area.
Amazing.
Knowing your podcast was coming, and it was kind of connecting my passion for Holocaust theatre, but also Holocaust education, I really couldn't say no to coming on and supporting you today while Alex is sadly on tour doing her acting thing, which I do not miss at all. So that's like my life really. I'm currently got two dogs, a husband, and living in a wee village in the Highlands of Scotland.
Amazing. So when Alex next comes over to the UK, I feel a road trip coming on.
Absolutely. Like we're at the very, very top. It'll take you hours to get here. It takes me 6 hours to drive from here to my family in Edinburgh, And I can get to London quicker from Edinburgh. So yeah.
Wow. Okay, I mean, I think it's also worth pointing out that the reason we are recording on a Monday when normally we would be releasing on the Monday, and the reason why we're recording on the Monday is because John lives that remotely that his internet went down to record
Yes.
last week, which was epic. I was like, yep, that tracks. Yep. But
Welcome to the Highlands.
I mean, and cue Scottish music.
Yep.
So what we normally do before we sort of plunge into the disclaimers and the episode is we talk about any Holocaust plays, films, articles, books that we've either read or that are coming up, or that we've seen that we want to give a shout out or we want to recommend. So I have one. Do you have any?
Got one play and two kind of films.
Ooh.
So yeah,
Okay, go for it.
I sadly missed Leopoldstadt when it was on at the National and did its West End run, and have literally read the play, loved it. I fell in love with the kind of this kind of Brechtian timeline of it kind of jumping backwards and forwards. And I then found myself being very bored in the kind of Scottish Highlands. So I downloaded it to watch via National Theatre at home. And I was just incredibly moved and absolutely gutted that I missed it. It was an astonishing play that really told a family's history and stuff that I suppose as Jewish people we really have kind of heard about. We've heard about the kind of pogroms, we've heard about anti-Semitism, we've heard about the Holocaust, and thankfully have never lived anything through that. That has been kind of contemporary until quite recently, I would say. And this play kind of brought that all to life. It kind of made it very, very, very current, very raw, seeing a family's history through the eyes of what we had heard as a community. And I was really moved by it. And it's definitely a play that I would like to study further, and definitely one I would take into the classroom and use as a tool to teach about the actual Holocaust, but also about anti-Semitism through the ages as well, and getting young people to realize that the Holocaust just didn't happen. It wasn't a one-off. So that was the first one. And then I've just came back from a trip to Poland, actually. I rewatched the Zone of Interest. I don't know if you've
Oh,
seen it.
yeah.
So my sister, so this, so our tour guide in Auschwitz had mentioned it, and my sister hadn't watched it before, so I said to her to watch it, and then I watched it again. And you tend to find yourself really listening to the soundtrack more than anything else, and really what you're seeing on screen is kind of just a kind of filler, really. And the real character and the real story is what you actually hear. But I think for me, the key moment is when the central character starts to retch, as he's kind of walking down the stairs, and you kind of question what his body is retching at, and that kind of it's a natural response for his body to kind of go through. And is it to do with his wife? Is it to do with what he's hearing? Is it to do with his own actions? Is it all of it together? So that was quite interesting. And then that made me then go and rewatch the 1978 TV series Holocaust with Meryl Streep, that I think you spoke about earlier, actually,
We
on your
did,
podcast.
yeah. So Alex sort of touched upon it, sort of that moment where the Holocaust started to really seep into American consciousness through
Kind of became quite
literally Holocaust, the miniseries.
mainstream. So I was watching that, and then it kind of just got me kind of realizing actually there is so much going on today regarding anti-Semitism that I think it's really important that we realize that, as I said earlier, the Holocaust just didn't happen. It didn't just kind of happen overnight. It was centuries in the kind of making, and we need to be really, really careful that we never go back to that. And as a community, I think we are concerned that things are going backwards. So yeah, so that's the kind of three things I was wanting to speak about.
Brilliant. So, just for listeners who don't know about Leopoldstadt, it's a literally epic, broad sweeping play written by Tom Stoppard that essentially charts sort of a bourgeoisie, very sort of middle, upper middle class family in Vienna through like the kind of the turn of the century through sort of like the 30s through into the Holocaust and sort of follows the family. I did see it when it transferred to the West End, and for me it was a bit Game of Thrones, not because there were lots of boobs and murder, but just because it's there's so many characters, you have to just sit back and let the story wash over you because you try and pin down who's who. There's a cast of like that, it's got to be at least 20, all in sort of this one family, or related to this family in different ways. And it's one of the things that I really loved about it is the emphasis on pre-war Jewish life. So it's not just the lives that were lost, but it was the culture and the vitality and the vibrancy of people's lives. So I wasn't actually aware that it was available on National Theatre at home. Guess what I'm downloading? And the Zone of Interest, like you said, if listeners haven't heard of it, where have you been? But it focuses on Rudolf Hess, who was the most infamous commandant of Auschwitz, and ostensibly it looks at the daily life of sort of him and his family, and what happens. And as John was saying, you don't see the camp. I don't think you ever actually go into the camp, but the soundscape, and it's a very. I think we're probably both thinking of the same moment when we talk about the soundscape, which is when Hearst's wife is showing her mother around the garden, and she's taking her through like these different sections of the garden, and they're not speaking at all, but all you can hear are the sounds of the camp, and they gradually seep into your consciousness, and you become aware of what you're listening to. And that moment where he's retching, is that a spoiler alert? No, it's not a spoiler alert, but it's towards the end. And he is walking down a staircase in one of the offices, and suddenly, like you say, starts as if he is going to be sick. And then he sort of turns and stares directly at the camera. And there are so many different ways to interpret it. Like you say, is his body reacting to the physical trauma? Is he reacting to what other things that he has done? Not going to give a spoiler. I read it as him reacting to the realization of how history will perceive him, and that realization that history is looking at him. But I feel like this could be another episode, and I feel like maybe we should look at, maybe that's one of the things we could talk about with Alex, is do a special episode on the Zone of Interest, because I'm hearing so many different things from different educators. And yeah, it's not theatre, but the play that I'm going to be seeing in the middle of June, because that's when it opens, is called Who is Claude Cahun? I'm hoping I pronounced that right. I'm probably not. It's by D.R. Hill, and it's going to be on at the Southwark Playhouse in London from the 18th of June until the 12th of July. And essentially, it looks at queer Holocaust history. So I've got the synopsis slash blurb here, and it says, "Born Lucy Schwab, a queer artist and writer, part of the surrealist movement in Paris in the 1930s, Claude Cahun struggled in their search for gender identity in the male-dominated art world. From a Jewish family, they relocated to the island of Jersey with their long-term partner, Marcel Moore, born Suzanne Malherbe. When the island was occupied by the Nazis in 1940, the pair used guerrilla art to actively resist the occupying forces. Pursued by the Gestapo, their true story is a forgotten tale of courage and determination to be true to personal identity. Who is Claude Cahun shines a light on real-life resistant heroes left invisible for too long." So as soon as I saw this was on, I was like, and yes, I will be buying the tickets for that. Thank you very much. So I've bought tickets to one of the previews.
And actually what's going to be interesting is the whole Channel Islands aspect. And when I'm educating, I cover the Channel Islands, because a lot of young people don't realize that actually it came that close to us, and that Britain's part of the Channel Islands, or Channel Islands is part of Britain. So anything to do with the Holocaust and the Channel Islands, I think, needs more coverage. So it's really going to be interesting what this play is going to tell us.
Exactly. And I haven't looked, I deliberately haven't looked up any of the history because I want to see the play first and then go back and look at the history and go, oh, okay, what, you know, like we all do with Holocaust theatre, what's quote-unquote true, what's been fictionalised. But yeah, like I said, well, like you say, as soon as I saw it was also the Channel Islands, I was like, oh, let's go. Like, so, because for me, it combines two elements of not necessarily hidden history, but unhighlighted histories, which mm-hmm. is the queer history. And the Nazi persecution of the LGBTQIA plus community.
Yeah.
And also, like you say, the Channel Islands and the repressed history of mm-hmm. that. And you're so right. You know, so many young people don't know about the Nazi occupation of the Channel Islands and, you know, the three Jewish women that ultimately were deported to Auschwitz and murdered. So I will come back with a full report and a review.
Brilliant.
So there we go. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's time for the disclaimers. Number one, John and I both work for outside organisations. As John said, he works at a school, but this podcast is entirely on us. So we don't represent our organisations in this capacity. We're not speaking for them. This is our passion project. Well, Alex and I started it, and now we've got John involved. So if you don't like something you hear, please blame us.
Number two, the Holocaust, it's an incredibly dark subject area. So because we work with it every day, we use humour as a coping mechanism. We are not mocking the Holocaust at all. We're not mocking any of the victims or survivors. We in no way intend to be disrespectful. We do use dark humour at times. I do love a bit of dark humour, I have to say. So please bear this in mind while listening to this episode and to the podcast as a whole.
And number three is our rule of engagement. If you have questions, a suggestion for an episode, a correction, a comment, let us know. You can find the contact details in the show notes, and who knows, you might end up doing a John and making a comment and then ending up as guest co-host. So
just be warned, okay? And skippers, you can stop clicking ahead, okay? Shall we?
Let's do it. So today we're looking at Fear and Misery of the Third Reich by Bertolt Brecht, translated by John Willett. Now, this was the piece that you reached out to me about as being one of the first Holocaust plays, and I'm so happy I get to talk about it with you. You've worked with it quite extensively.
Yeah.
Can you give us the synopsis?
Yeah. So this is one of Brecht's earlier plays. For those of you who don't know about Bertolt Brecht, he is a German playwright who basically fled Germany during Nazi-occupied Germany. His work is quite political. So this play, Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, was written before World War II began, and it's 24 miniature plays. So it follows his kind of episodic nature of his work, and the plays are all unique. They can all be standalone plays, they can all work together. The plays each tell a different aspect of German life within Germany under Nazi occupation. It really gives us a real insight into what life was like. We do cover elements of Jewish life, we cover the kind of paranoia that was inherent within Germany. There's a play about Jehovah's Witnesses. There is some of the plays are about political views. So I mean, it's like it's really this kind of story arc of living in a really polarized, paranoid period of time. I would say from 1933 to about 1936-37.
I'm very in danger of launching straight into discussion because it feels so relevant and so timely with Yeah, we'll come to that in a second. But just to give a little bit more context around Brecht and his work, because you and I were theatre kids, John. So, you know, we were the drama students, darling. We were all the, you know, tits, teeth and jazz hands. So anybody who has studied drama in any capacity will have heard of Brecht. But I think it's worth just giving a quick overview of his life, just so that, you know, the non-theatre kids in the room can get an understanding of him. So there's honestly so much about the man, because he was so influential and such an incredible practitioner. There are genuinely dozens of books that you can go and read and learn more about his life. So it was a bit of a challenge to try and find sort of a short biography of him that didn't go into huge detail, but didn't just kind of go, he was a German bloke who did some plays. But I did find one. So I am quoting massively from poetryfoundation.org. And as ever, all of the sources for today's show will be in the show notes. And it just, I'll go into it. So he was one of the most influential playwrights of the 20th century, with works including the Threepenny Opera with composer Kurt Weill, Mother Courage and Her Children, The Resistible Rise of Arturo Uy. Brecht was born in Augsburg, Bavaria in 1898. And the two world wars directly affected his life and works. He wrote poetry when he was a student, but studied medicine, which I didn't know, at the Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. After military service during World War I, he abandoned his medical studies to pursue writing and the theatre. He was a member of the Independent Social Democratic Party, and he wrote theatre criticism for a socialist newspaper from 1919 to 1921. His plays were banned in Germany in the 1930s, and in 1933 he went into exile, first in Denmark and then Finland. And it was while he was in Denmark that he wrote Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, based on correspondence with people who were living in Nazi Germany and things that he'd heard from them. He moved to Santa Monica in California in 1941. He hoped to write for Hollywood, but perhaps unsurprisingly, he drew the attention of the House Un-American Activities Committee. So although he managed to deflect accusations of being a communist, he moved to Switzerland after the hearings and then relocated to East Berlin in 1949, where he ran the Berliner Ensemble. And as a director, and this is probably what he's most famous for, he advocated the alienation effect in acting, which is an approach intended to keep the audience emotionally uninvolved in the plights of the characters. And he continued working in the theatre, developing techniques, developing his practice, developing epic theatre until he died in 1956. So he actually had quite a short life, and he is buried in Berlin. And like I said, anyone who has studied drama in any way, shape or form will have heard of Brecht.
Absolutely, yeah. And when we go to drama school, we tend to study Stanislavski, which is the more natural way of acting. And if you see Brecht as the opposite of that.
And that's how it's taught as well. Yeah. It's kind of, you have, oh, Stanislavski and the 19th century and the magic if and slice of life and
absolutely
naturalism, not to be confused with naturism. That's something very different. And then, yeah, Brecht, like you say, is kind of the polar opposite and kind of rejects all of this. Mm-hmm. So, John, what are your experiences of working with fear? I'm trying to call it Fear and Misery. I'm not going to keep using the whole title.
Yeah.
Working with Fear and Misery, seeing it. Yeah.
So I read it at university and I loved it. I loved how each of the plays told its own story. However, the episodic nature gave it this story arc across the whole piece. I've seen some really bad productions of it at the Edinburgh Fringe in particular. And whenever I see it on, I have to go and see it. I have to admit, I've never seen a good production of it.
Wow.
I know.
Wow.
And it has really upset me. I think because I am so passionate about it, it's going to have to take something incredibly special for it to be good.
Sorry, I have to, how is it not possible for anyone to have done, or is this you, come on, be honest, is this you being super picky, or are they genuine.
No.
I don't think he would be necessarily, but
I think it's not typically a play that would like go into the West End. It's not typically a
no.
play that you would see at a rep company, so or it would go on tour. So it's quite niche. I have seen a really good production of The Jewish Wife, which is one of the 24 plays, and it's probably the longest of the 24 plays. And I've seen it as a standalone piece. So it was a 30-minute production. It was absolutely stunning, and I'm gonna talk about that when I talk about The Jewish Wife. But I have directed it. So I used it with my second year actors when I was lecturing at Edinburgh College, which is a drama school in Edinburgh. The way I kind of did it was unlike a lot of other Brecht's plays. This one's actually quite nat. This is quite naturalistic in the kind of writing style. So although each of the 24 scenes starts with a kind of song or a kind of rhyming verse, the dialogue is very kind of natural. So my set design was two Nazi flags coming down as on the back side. The floor was painted with the Nazi emblem on the floor. And then I always had this kind of image in my head of the blonde kind of Hitler youth boy in the kind of propaganda kind of painting posters with the drum. So I had one of my actors dressed as a Hitler youth with the drum standing on a rostra box, which is just like a raised platform, for those of you who are not into theatre. And he basically tapped the drum at the end of every scene to show the audience there was like a new scene happening. Outtake of that, the play lasted 2 hours and there was no interval, and he ended up passing out during the take. So
No.
yes, we had to.
I've heard
So
of suffering from your art, but
yeah,
oh
so we had to find a way to support him. So the rostra box ended up having a kind of a barrier at the back that he could like lean on, and it looked amazing. So I was quite happy with that. And I had the actors sitting facing the audience, so the audience understood that they were watching a play, and the actors were all dressed in evening wear. So it was like tuxes and tuxedos and ball gowns, and it was to show kind of German bourgeois lifestyle, but telling these stories of just ordinary German people. It was probably one of the best plays I've ever directed because I was so passionate about it. And each of the scenes, although we had those epic kind of aspects of epic theatre storytelling, I ended up having the naturalism within my kind of scenes. So they were using Stanislavskian acting techniques as they were telling the kind of story. So I've still got to see a full production that I really enjoy, but
But you didn't
obviously,
direct, so
yeah, that I didn't direct, and I can't take credit for it. But it is such a good play for young actors to get their teeth into because it really gives them a chance to explore that whole dramaturgy point of view of drama research, knowing the background of a piece. Really getting their heads around Holocaust education, really getting their teeth into two different theatre practitioners, Brecht and Stanislavski, and working with a classic text as well. So for me, it was just a great text to work with young actors who were really trying to hone their craft. And because it's such an important topic for me, I knew that they were going to do it well as well. And they did. That was
I just
my.
want to circle back around something that you said because I realized that we've used epic in air quotes in two different contexts in this episode already. So I talked about Leopoldstadt as being a literally epic piece of theatre, and then we talk
Being
about
fantastic
epic
piece of theatre.
theatre in terms of Brecht. So I'm going to defer back to the expert. If you were going to summarize epic theatre in the context of Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, how would you do it?
Okay, so for me, epic theatre is when everything is larger than life. Okay, we're not we're like we're not talking about pantomime. We are talking about the
Oh no, we're not.
gestures.
Sorry,
Yeah.
continue.
Oh yes, we are. No. But we're talking about the gestures that they use. So one of the scenes, a case of betrayal, it is two neighbors who are listening at the door as the Nazis have gone into their tenement building and arrested one of their neighbors because they were listening to a radio station that wasn't allowed. And the whole conversation is between a man and wife, and they're bickering behind this door, listening at the door. The wife's nervous, the husband is kind of like panicking. So, in a naturalist scene, your movements would be quite small, quite kind of natural. Whereas in epic theatre, his pacing would be really exaggerated. Her nervousness might be seen as a twitch, but the twitch would get bigger and stronger as the scene goes on. The looks that they would give each other would be quite comical at times, but quite over the top, and quite choreographed. And that's probably a good word to use. I would say that epic theatre is quite choreographed. Everything needs to be done with intent to make the audience realize that they're watching a piece of theatre.
And that also feeds into the episodic nature of the piece, right? Because you're
Yes.
not following two or three central characters who then appear throughout the entire thing. Every single piece out of the every single scene out of the 24 in Fear and Misery is different characters. It doesn't say that they're the same at any point. So you're not allowed to kind of get sucked in to what and sort of have that escapism that people traditionally associate with theatre. Of you go in, you sort of, and I think was it Brecht who said they hang their brains up with their hats in the cloakroom, and you go in, you sit down, you forget where you are for a couple of hours, have an ice cream
And you
at the
don't have
interval,
to
come back
think,
in,
yeah.
and then you might at the end go, oh, I was so sad, or oh, that made me laugh so much, but that's really as much as it goes.
Whereas Brecht wants you to think and wants you to know that you're watching a play and wants you to question everything that you are seeing. And in one of the plays, Occupational Disease, the key character is a doctor and he's kind of visiting different patients who have been badly injured by the kind of Nazis during Roundup, but he keeps telling the junior doctors to ask questions, and they keep repeating, "What do you need to do? Ask questions. What do you have to do? Ask questions." And that's literally Brecht telling the audience, "You need to ask questions at the government, at your politicians, at what you're seeing. Do not forget that your job as a citizen is to ask questions." So even in his writing, he's telling the audience to ask questions constantly. So.
So, like we said, there's the so you have worked with it extensively, you've directed it. What are your let's start with what are your least favorite scenes or episodes in Fear and Misery
Do you know what, Sam?
before we move into the favorite ones?
I actually don't have. I actually think they're all really, really well written, and I think they're all really well. They each tell a different aspect of German life. I have least favorites. I've definitely got my kind of collective of these are the scenes that I love and that I think are really important. But I think every single scene tells the important aspects of the Jehovah's Witnesses and the impact on name, or the scientists and the impact on name, or the people who were asking questions. One of the scenes, it's a scene where this man has died within a camp and his body's been sent back, but it is in an iron coffin, so they can't open it. And they are basically one of his I think it's one of his sons or one of his neighbors is trying to open it and saying, "Look, we need to know what's happened. We can't believe what the Nazis have told us. Why would you return a body that is in an iron coffin?" But the wife is completely like, "If you do that, we're going to get into more trouble, and I don't want to know. I just want to have him back in the family. He's here, and that's the most important part." But her paranoia is that she doesn't want any more trouble at her door. But the other people in the family are like, "No, we need answers to this." So although it's a kind of I suppose it's slightly boring within the context of the 24 plays, it still tells a really important aspect of that paranoia that people were living with and the conflict within families of, do we ask questions? Do we just go along with the rest of the community and the rest of the citizens? Or do we stand up for what we believe in and what is right? So yeah, I think and I actually think that's probably why I haven't enjoyed any production that I have actually seen, because as we all know, at the Edinburgh Fringe, you've got like a 60-minute slot and you need to cut certain bits of it. And I just feel like in this, although it's 24 individual plays, you can't cut anything from it because each of the scenes adds up to what life was like in Germany. Each of the scenes adds up to fear and misery under the Third Reich. So when I go and see a production in the Fringe, they've cut so many scenes that actually I'm just like, what is this, a showcase? So yeah. So
And I think that's one of the things as well, is that the scenes are all different lengths. It's not like they're all, 24 scenes of 2 pages. I think, like you're saying, that the Jewish wife is the longest one, and then there's others that are literally a page and a half. And you, as you start to read it, you go, "What am I going to learn from this?" And you get to the end of that page and a half, and you're like, "Damn." But that was intense. And it, relatively speaking, very little will have been said, but an entire situation, or an entire it just and that's one of the things I really engage with in this, in terms of Breck's writing, is that it's so pithy and it's punchy and it gets to it, and you kind of get that. It's almost like a you have to kind of catch your breath and go, oh God, this was happening. And circling back around to what you were saying about family and that whole notion of the family, the scene, I can't remember the name of it now, but it's the one where it's, is it the spy? And it's the
Yes,
mum and dad
and
talking about, they're
that
convinced,
paranoia, and the son just leaves
being
the room.
absolutely paranoid about what their son has, they're sort of having, that they're at home, they're having a conversation, and having a bit of a kvetch, as people do when they think they're safe at home. And then their son is in the Hitler Youth, is umming and ahhing about whether or not to go out. Then he goes out, and suddenly there's this paranoia around, well, hang on, what did you say, anything critical about the not, well, you said. And then they sort of descend into like this bickering and this blame, and it's
But they actually miss the most important character in the whole scene, which is the maid.
yeah,
So
who is
he's
probably going to be
eavesdropping and
listening.
listening. Yeah, totally.
And then they're sort of going, oh, well, where's he going to have got? And they're ringing around, and going, oh, it's, we're just wondering if Karl Heinrich's there. Oh no, he's not. No, I'm sure he'll be back soon. And the suspicion is growing, and it's almost farcical. Like it really definitely has elements of farce, where they're starting to blame each other, and it's comical at the same time as you realizing the very real danger they could be in. And then he bowls back in carrying a paper bag and is like, oh yeah, I just went to get some chocolate. And you have that moment where you kind of, and then he goes out, and as a reader, as an audience member, you kind of laugh and go, and then one parent turns to the other and says, do you think he was telling the truth? And then you're like, oh, this situation is not resolved at all. Like, they're
No,
never going to know.
and that's like two parents questioning the their 10-year-old son. And it's that whole paranoia in each of the kind of scenes that you see, that does give you the overarching theme of fear and misery. And I don't think you can cut anything out of it. And I think that is the downfall of major productions that happen across the UK and probably the globe, or when they do this, is that they try and cut scenes from it and it just then doesn't make sense really. So
I wonder if it's looking at the whys, the whats, the wherefores, like what they think audiences are going to engage with, like what they think, oh, this is quote unquote interesting, or this is more engaging, rather than going, no, they have to. Because for me, maybe because I'm a nerd, every scene is interesting in some way, in different ways. But yeah, I think that's really, yeah, like.
And I think, and but I but like I also think the director, if you've got a director who understands Holocaust education and understands the importance of that pre-World War II life of the German people, then you're not going to cut any scene. So because each of these now one of the groups that isn't mentioned is the LGBT community in Fear and Misery. But if you look at Brecht's writing at the time and when he was writing, he wouldn't have been mentioning it anyway, because it was just not a done thing back then. But if you do look at some of the scenes, there are underlying elements that this character is gay, and that is why he's been questioned, and he's came out, and the family don't want anything to do with them. And I think you need, when you are studying this play or you're directing this play, you need to have knowledge that's more extensive than just I've read a Wikipedia page on Brecht and I know what I'm doing. So that's why I think a lot of productions fail, because they end up cutting scenes that are that they think are boring, or that they think the audience aren't going to get, and then it just takes away something from the overarching message of the play.
It also makes me question as well what, as well as, it's that whole thing around people working with what they think they know. I mean, obviously, you don't know what you don't know, but then, yeah, just, I mean, you and I have spoken before about representations of Jehovah's Witnesses in Holocaust theatre. And to the best of my knowledge, and I've searched and searched, I cannot find a play that deals exclusively with the experiences of the Jehovah's Witnesses. And the sort of conclusion that I've been forced to draw, very unfortunately, is that it's because, particularly in Western society, Jehovah's Witnesses, to a certain extent, are still somehow seen as quote unquote undesirable. That's another conversation for another time. But
But
again, just that element gone.
then you've got Brecht in 1936 writing a play on it. So because he understood that no one was going to be left out by the Nazis and their kind of punishment of people. And if you've got a director or a theatre company removing that scene from the play, then actually you're actually erasing a whole community, and you're erasing a whole part of history that
Absolutely.
Brecht is trying to teach us. So,
So yeah, again, factoring in elements like the Roma and Sinti and the experiences of people of colour, and just how few, comparatively few plays there are that document and represent their experiences. So go on then, let's, because I'm really, really excited for this bit. The favourite ones. What's the
Okay,
favourite episodes?
so my favorite episodes, I'm going to talk about the Jewish wife last, because it's the one that I do just, I think it's an incredible piece of writing. So, but the one that you talked about, the spy, I love it. I think it's a beautiful piece of theater. It's so great to see two parents turn into the kind of child role within the play. They are so paranoid. Like, they've sent their child to the Hitler Youth, and then they get so paranoid because the dad's kind of completely against what's like he's reading in the paper, and the mum is just like listening to what he's saying. And as they're arguing, the child vanishes, and the couple just end up having this massive argument about what the dad's saying in front of the child. The mum's getting worried that he's going to go back and tell the Hitler Youth. The Hitler Youth are then going to come to their door, with the kind of Nazi party. They're going to get arrested. And this whole paranoia plays out in the space of like 5, 10 minutes. But it is what you were saying, it's the comedy aspect of it. It's the comedy aspect that they cannot trust their 10-year-old child, who has literally just went to the shops to buy a bag of sweets, yet they're ignoring the kind of spy in the room, which is the maid. I have seen it done once, which I absolutely loved, and the maid was dressed in drag, and it was definitely a man playing the maid woman, and which made it even more funnier because you are like, you're missing the obvious suspect here. And even at the end, when the child leaves the room again, and the dad and the mum are just like, do you think he like heard what we were saying? Do you think he's told anybody? Like, the maid is still standing behind them, and she's got her notebook out and she's taking little notes. It was like, you can't trust anybody, even your 10-year-old son. Another scene that I absolutely loved was the black shoes, and it's such a small scene, it's only like a page or something, but it's about a mum and a daughter. The mum is peeling potatoes, the daughter's doing a tap dance, and she is the mum realizes she's needing a new pair of shoes for kind of school, and she's very, very poor, which plays into the whole history of Germany and their kind of economic the downturn during World War I and World War II, and the Nazis blaming the Jews for that. So the mum's peeling her potatoes, and she's talking just about how she can't afford to live, and that her daughter's needing a new pair of shoes. But her daughter is more obsessed about going with her friends and going to the Hitler Youth. So it was this whole scene about how the German government were trying to push over the Hitler Youth as this thing that every young person needs to do. It's part of your country, it's part of your upbringing, you should be able to go there. The young daughter is saying, but they'll send me to the countryside for my holiday, and I'll be able to be with my friends, and they'll do this with me and they'll do that with me. And the mum's just like, I don't have money for this, you are not doing it. And the daughter is throwing this whole tantrum about it. And it kind of just, it's a really simple kind of scene, but you kind of see the kind of mother really struggling to say no to her daughter. A, over paranoia. Again, she's paranoid, she's going to get in trouble if she doesn't send her daughter to the Hitler Youth. But B, this whole financial strain, and then you've also got questions about, like, where's the dad? Like, is the dad being taken away? Is the dad fighting? Is the dad being called up? Is the dad in the Nazi party? You've got that whole background to that as well.
You said that the daughter is doing a tap dance. Was that in a version that you'd seen? Because in the version that I've read, she's sitting there doing her homework.
Okay. So that's the version I've seen.
There
So
you go. So,
yeah,
and
so
it's that, and for me, it was really heartbreaking in the text because, the daughter is saying, I just need 2 pfennigs to, I have to take it every week. It's like my dues to go to the group, and the mum's like, I can't afford it, and then the daughter seems to take it quite well and is sort of quite understanding, and it's like, oh, okay, but and then they start talking about her shoes and how she needs new shoes, and then the mum gets very focused on, okay, we've got to get the shoes repaired and we'll have to get this sorted out and so on and so forth, and you can see her mind kind of tending towards that's the mum going, that's what's important, is that you have shoes that don't have holes in, that you're not going to get your
Absolutely.
feet wet. And then the daughter's like, great, so then can I have the 2 pfennigs to go to the group? And the mum's like, I can't afford it. And then that's the end of the scene, and you're kind of like, oh, so again, like you say, feeding into those priorities of, well, I have to take care of my child's physical welfare, and it's that, well, I can either mend your shoes or I can send you to, I can't remember if it's Hitler Youth or League of German Girls, but I can't do both. And again, it's that if she mends the shoes but doesn't send her to the youth group, that could be a problem. But if she sends her to the youth group, she's not going to have suitable shoes for the. So, like you're saying, with the Great Depression and the economics side of things, and then that also feeds into how Hitler and the Nazis got into power, right? Because he turns around and says, bread and work, and I'll, make Germany great again. And then that's kind of leads into
But
how
also
they came
that,
into power.
but also that leads into the whole mantra of the sign above Auschwitz and other concentration camps, with work sets you free, and the whole tap dancing bit actually came from my own production.
Now the truth's out.
But that was her homework. She was creating a rhythm, and I remember it now. She was creating a rhythm. So when there was silence, all you would hear would be this beat, 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 beat. Mm. We then start driving the mum more insane. So, but yeah, that was her homework, was to go over our tap dancing. Because obviously I'm a musical theatre kid.
I was going
to
say, theatre kid.
So that's what my homework was. but no, you are totally right. It is that, like, what's so powerful about this scene is that the mum knows what she needs to support her daughter, but her daughter's pushing the mum for stuff that she doesn't really need, as any kid would do. I want the latest Game Boy, I want the latest this. Well, no, you need to get trainers that fit you. You need to get, So one of the other plays that I really loved was The Old Militant, which you spoke about earlier. Oh. So why did you like that one? Tell me.
Because I think the thing that immediately sucked me in was the opening verse, which I shall take the liberty of reading for you now.
Okay.
Because it could not be more relevant, more timely, more proof that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
The whole piece, but this particular, it says, "Behold, several million electors, 100% in all sectors, have asked to be led by the nose. They didn't get real bread and butter. They didn't get warm coats or fodder. They did get the leader they chose." You look at the state of the world today, and I'm gonna stick my neck out and say it. You look at America today,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that whole thing about real bread and butter, and then, you know, they've it feels like they have been led. A lot of people in America, not all Americans, have been led with promises. And now they've gotten the leader that they chose. They've gotten who they voted for. And just the whole thing around the old militant of people waiting outside shops in a village, dark winter's morning, having conversations with dairy woman, and talking about what's happened to the butcher and how the old man, or the old quite old militant who's been, you know, sort of running his mouth off and not been happy with, you know, well, I voted for Hitler, and, you know, now all of these things are happening, and all the promises that have been made, and, you know, the economic stability that we were promised hasn't come to fruition because he's a butcher. And, you know, there's this whole thing about him being told to hang like a false ham and a fake side of veal
in the window
of his shop.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert forthcoming. They have, you know, the customers are having all these conversations about him, and then they see the light starting to come in the shop as the butcher's wife is sort of trying to carry on as normal. And then they see that the half-lit shop window does actually have something hanging in it.
Yeah.
And when they look, it's actually the old man. He's hanged himself in the shop window, and there's a sign around his neck that says, "I voted for Hitler."
Yeah.
So just for me, that whole, and that scene is 3 and a bit pages, not even 3-4 pages,
and it's actually emotional. It's a really emotional scene.
Oh, it so is.
Like it really just punches you in the kind of stomach when the last line of the scene is, it says, "I voted for Hitler." And then that's where it ends. They are all desperate. Like, they're all desperate for food. They're all desperate for more rations. There's talk of, like, butter. There's, like, no butter again today. And then there's a person saying that's all they can afford these days. Then they're talking about sacrifices, what they can eat and what they can't. And then you just see that even the butcher's wife, when she comes out, like, she's trying to be upbeat, and she's trying to stay positive, and she's like, "Good morning. Have you seen Richard today? He should have been here with the meat well before now. I wonder what's going on." And then all of a sudden she sees her husband dead in the shop window. And it's just, it goes back to what you were saying, but even more closer to home. It, like, just, and again, I'm putting my neck above the line here, sorry political people, but like, reform getting so many votes in the English elections was really scary. Like, Nigel Farage lied to the public. He told us about a bus giving like so many millions of pounds to the NHS
Yeah, for the
and
British
sending
Brexit,
yeah
yeah.
and sending Brexit and sending immigrants back home and blah blah blah. And then people believed him and voted for Brexit, and none of that's happened. And now he's changed his party, and people are voting for him again. So I mean, even just looking at this, I think what's great about Brecht is that each of the plays gives us a specific place in Germany. So in the old Militin, it was Kalau, and it was in 1938. So it's a specific time period, and it's a specific place, and it's relevant today. Everything's relevant today. The case of betrayal with the parents and the child, the mother struggling to buy shoes for her child, but the child needs more stuff. The old militant voting for someone who's lied to him. Like, these aren't new stories, and they're still so powerful.
And even factoring in things like, and again, coming back to the situation in America, but education being under attack, subject matter experts being under attack, and when you think about in Fear and Misery, the scientists, and it's, an incredibly, and I hold my hands up as someone who has 3 degrees in how to be unemployed. You read these two scientists are having a conversation, and it's very clear that they're having to keep what they're talking about a secret and not be overheard. Yeah, it's like, shh, don't say anything, don't tell anybody. But then they
Lots of kind
start
of whispering, lots
forgetting.
of kind of paranoia about who's in the next
Yeah,
room. Can I
exactly.
talk
And
to you
we could
just
be
now?
out overheard, and then they're talking about, there's lots of scientific formulas, and you kind of go, okay, I'm not, and oh, we're looking at this, we're looking at this, and then X equals this, and then you get that. You learn as they're talking that they've obviously been sent this information by somebody, or they have contact somewhere who's reached like an unmentionable, and then the whole piece, and I'll come to it in a second, the whole piece builds to this kind of crescendo where they forget where they are and what they're talking about, and they utter this
Get so
name
excited, yeah.
once. They
Yeah.
utter the name once, and then they are absolutely terrified, and then become this whole big thing about, oh no, but couldn't possibly, doesn't make any sense, and that couldn't possibly be right. And the only thing they say once that they have to be terrified of is Einstein.
Yeah.
And just that whole thing of, A, obviously Einstein was Jewish, but also that thing of this like incredibly clever genius and the threat that the Nazis saw him as, to the extent that his works are forbidden, he is exiled. And again, I'm not saying we've necessarily reached that point in countries like America, but it feels like we're getting bloody close, especially with all of the immigration policies and all the horror stories that are coming out of people being detained by ICE and having phones checked for social media and passports, and medics who are,
But I mean,
university lecturers being
but I
turned
mean, just
away or
even, but I
deported.
mean, just I mean, even hearing Nigel Farage talk about getting rid of diversity, equality, and inclusion practices,
Nigel, you're married to a German. Shut up. Anyway.
That's in Britain, and it's scary. It is
Horrifying. Yeah.
absolutely, it's like petrifying that Trump's policies are coming over here. But actually, how you're reading Fear and Misery of the Third Reich, and actually you're mirroring it to what's happening in the Western world today, almost 100 years later. So these aren't new ideas. These aren't new policies, and Fear and Misery shows us that in each of the scenes. It gives us a glimpse of what our life could actually end up being like.
And the thing that I love about it, and I'm always very wary about using words like, oh, things I really enjoyed about the play or I loved about the play, but the thing that I do really love about this is it kind of shows you how, not easily, but how people could have said no and how people could have turned around and done something about it and done what was quote unquote right rather than what was easy. And when everybody kind of puts their head down and goes, oh no, but we don't want that to happen to us, not necessarily joining the dots and going, there are enough of us that if we all stand up and go, actually no, we're not okay with this, and do something and mobilize together and do things together, we can actually stop or slow or just do something.
Which is why I think the next scene that I really love is consulting the people. So it's the final scene of the whole play. And it's set in Berlin, and it's set in 1938 in a working class flat with two men and a woman. The constricted space is blocked by a flagpole, a great noise of jubilation from the radio with church bells and the sound of aircraft. A voice is saying, and now the Führer is about to enter Vienna. And they're seeing the kind of occupation of Austria at that time. And the woman smooths out a really small piece of crumpled paper, and the older worker says to her, "What have you got there?" And the whole scene is about them standing up to hatred and saying, "But what can we do? There's only three of us. There's not a lot that we can do to change." So she basically gets this piece of paper, and she said, "It's a copy of a letter. I'm going to read it out. Dear son, tomorrow I shall have ceased to be. Executions are usually at 6 a.m. I'm writing now because I want you to know I haven't changed my opinions, nor have I applied for a pardon because I didn't commit any crime. I just served my class. And if it looks as though I got nowhere like that, it isn't so. Every man to his post should be our motto. Our task is very difficult, but it's the greatest one there is, to free the human race from its oppressors. Till that's done, life has no other value. Let that out of our sight, and the whole human race will relapse into barbarianism. You're still quite young, but it won't hurt you to remember always which side you are on. Stick with your own class, then your father won't have suffered this unhappy fate in vain, because it isn't easy. Look after your mother, your brothers, and your sister too. You're the eldest. Better be clever. Greetings to you all, your loving father." And then the older worker says, "There aren't really that few of us after all." And then the younger worker turns to him and says, "So what's to go into this referendum leaflet then?" And the woman, thinking, says, "The best thing would just be one word: no." And it makes me emotional. And when I directed it, I said I had the cast facing the audience, and each of the cast took one sentence from that letter and read it as they kind of stood up. And then on the no, the lights went to blackout. I think it's such an important, like, none of us are going to change anything, but as a collective, we can do so much. And one voice added to another voice, and then to another voice, and to another voice, can make so much change. I'm a humanitarian. I stand up for a lot of different things, but mainly LGBT and Jewish life. And it's hard to put your neck above that parapet sometimes. Mm. But if you don't speak about something, then no one's going to speak for you. And you're then going to reach out to someone who's also got the same connection to you, or the same beliefs. And then two heads are better than one, and then three heads are better than one. So for me, consulting the people, it's a really powerful scene. It gives us hope. It gives us an insight into knowing that there were people in Germany who were wanting to say no, to say this isn't correct.
It also has shades of Sophie Scholl and the White Rose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
As soon as I read it, I was like, this rings multiple bells.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think people forget that. And again, it goes back to what I said earlier, Sam, about, like, you can't take any of the scenes away from this play, because each of the scenes tells us an important context of life in Nazi Germany. And for this scene in particular, it's the fact there were good people. There were people who wanted to stand up, who wanted to say no, who wanted to say this isn't right. So yeah, the
and
final
think about that, what I could say as well, that the thing about that scene as well is the fact that, you know, it is set in 1938, it's the Anschluss, Austria has been annexed to Germany, and it's just that you feel the hope, but you also feel the hopelessness of that moment of they were still trying to say no. So yeah, the final one
I wanted to speak about was the Jewish wife. So this is set in Frankfurt in 1935. It's evening. A woman's packing suitcases. She's choosing what to take. Now and again, she removes something from her suitcase and returns it to the original place in the room in order to pack another item instead. For a long while, she hesitates whether to take a large photograph of her husband, which stands on a chest of drawers. Finally, she leaves the picture where it is. The packing tires her. And for a time, she sits on the suitcase, leaning her head on her hands. And then she gets to her feet and she telephones. So the beginning of this scene is she's making, I think it's four different phone calls she is making. And she basically, with each phone call, she is giving the listener excuse about where she's going and why she won't be around, and with each of the phone calls it gets more and more urgent, and it gets more and more upsetting, and it gets less and less formal. So the first phone call is to her doctor, and she's basically just trying to be really kind of polite and just say that she won't be able to make her appointment and to meet his wife for a bridge anymore. And then she hangs up, and then she calls another person, and it's a friend. And basically, she's basically saying that she would like this friend to look after her husband while she's gone. And then she phones her sister-in-law. And this is where it gets more kind of honest. And then she phones her friend, and basically you realize she's not got any options left. She needs to leave now before things get too much. She then tries to have a conversation in her head with her husband about what she's going to say to her husband, and she has this conversation over again. So this conversation stops and starts. And again, you can see that at the start of this, she is trying to be quite formal with them, not giving them the reality of what it actually is. And then she gives it full barrels, basically, and basically says that she's leaving because he's not sticking up for her. And she's leaving because people are going to make his life difficult because he's married to a Jewish woman. She is basically so honest that it actually hurts to even listen to what she's actually saying.
Yeah.
Because she loves him so much, but she realizes that he is never going to love her as much as she loves him.
And that's the thing as well, when she's kind of doing that like rehearsal of, you know, she's pretending he's there sitting in the chair, and she's going, so, and then she sort of stops, and like you say, she's like, okay. And then she tries a different way, and she sort of, I think she does like four or five different approaches. And it, I would love to see this, because it's such a phenomenal, it's a one woman show essentially, because he comes in for like the last 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And the rest of it is her on the phone or rehearsing what she's going to say to him. And then you kind of get this sense of, she obviously knows him, she's married to him, so these are all the different ways that she can see him responding. And then when he comes in, back to you.
Yeah. And I mean, like, one of the lines she says as she's rehearsing is, there you sit watching your wife pack and you see nothing. Walls have ears. Is that it? Again, you've got that whole paranoia playing. Mm. And then she says, hand me those underclothes, I'll need them. She's talking about, I'm going to have to do things that I never thought I'm going to have to do to try and survive here. And she keeps saying, don't tell me you're going to send me money when you know you're not going to be allowed to. And don't pretend this is only going to be for 3 or 4 weeks when we know this is going to last a lot longer than 3 or 4 weeks.
That's the whole thing, is that the whole premise that she's like you say, that as the calls get more and more urgent, the pretense that she begins with and sort of tries to keep up is that she's just going to Amsterdam for 2 or 3 weeks just to get away, just to, you know, and then you kind of go, oh no, wait. But then also with that bigger context of knowing what's going to happen, and that, you know, Holland or the Netherlands is not safe, quote unquote, and that the Nazis are going to occupy it. So,
and I think, and the kind of last line that she says before her husband actually enters is, don't hand me that fur coat that I shan't need till next winter, when he only thinks that she's only going to be away for a couple of weeks. And then he comes in and it all goes to very polite talk. Like, what are you doing? Tidying up? No. Why are you packing? I want to get away. So at this point, we know she's not being forced to go, but she's needing to like leave. And basically she's like, I'm going to go to Amsterdam. I'm going to get the 9:15 train. Well, where am I to send money to? Well, let's just say post restaurant, Amsterdam main post office. I see that they give me a special permit. Good God, I can't send my wife off with 10 marks a month. It's all lousy business. And then she says, I rang your sister. She'll see that you're all right. Quite unnecessary for 2 or 3 weeks. And then she says, do you mind handing me my fur coat? And then he hands her the fur coat. After all, it's only going to be for 2 or 3 weeks, he says to her, and that's the last line. And even talk about now, I'm getting upset, because we know this situation happened to so many Jewish families and Jewish women. The fact that she is seeing her future play out before we knew it was getting difficult for the Jews. Like, this was 1935, and many think, oh, but life for the Jews only got bad in 1939 when World War II started. No, it didn't.
The Nuremberg laws have entered the chat. Yeah,
absolutely. And the whole scene is just a powerful monologue from a woman trying to hold it together as her life is falling apart around her. And the production that I seen, which was a standalone production, and it was in London, and it was just the Jewish wife, and at the end, three Jewish wives. So the whole monologue was split up into three parts, which was great. So each of them had their own phone call, and then they had a phone call together, and then that monologue was all played out, and they had bits together like a Greek chorus. And then they had three husbands. But what really got me was the end, where she's got the fur coat in her hand, she's got her suitcase, and then she turns round, and the way they staged it, the husbands all went into darkness and they all put a Jewish star on her, and she turned around and she had the Jewish star on her jacket or on her top at like that point. And then people came in from the sides and started to take the suitcase and the jacket off her. And as they took the suitcase and the jacket off her, her suitcase, all three of their suitcases opened, and their belongings started to get chucked across the stage. And then as they turned around again, they were then stripped and they were put into the striped pajamas, as we kind of know. And then as she turned again, they were obviously wearing wigs, and the wigs came off and they were bald. And the shock of this choreography was so hard hitting. At the very end, the three women walked into a line together and then into a spotlight and then through smoke. And you just knew from the beginning of this scene, in Frankfurt in 1935, to the gas chambers of Auschwitz or whatever, that was her destination, because she was going to Amsterdam. We know what happened. People couldn't get out of the occupied countries. So visually, it was just a very striking piece at the end. But actually, the dialogue had led up to that moment. So with Brecht's dialogue and this direction and choreography and the visualness of it, I left that theatre a bubbling mess. And I'm telling you, it was literally maximum 45 minutes. So, and I was an emotional wreck. For me, it's one of the strongest pieces of theatre that's been written by Brecht. As a play overall, Feeding in Misery is absolutely stunning. I think it's a must for any drama student, but for any young person studying theatre at school, I think should be looking at it. It gives us a real insight into the history of what was happening in Germany at that time. And it's one of my favourite plays, really, to be honest. So.
Well, I think so. Just coming back to the Jewish wife again, I mean, no pun intended, there is so much to unpack with that piece. And I think one of the key things for me was I was, how can I was less than impressed at Fritz, the husband, sort of coming back in, and there was still that part of me that maybe had some Disney expectations of that he was going to come back in and prove her completely wrong, and that all of these different scenarios, it wouldn't be necessary for the sister-in-law that she patently doesn't get along with to look after him, because no, he was going to give everything up and he was going to go with her because that was
But
the right thing to do.
she preempted that right from the first stage direction, which reads, "For a long while she hesitates whether to take a large photograph of her husband that stands on the chest of drawers. Finally, she leaves the picture where it is, because she knows
Knows.
Fritz doesn't care about her."
But do you know what I mean? It's just that whole thing of, you know, even as you're watching it and you or you're reading it and you know he's not, because at no, I don't think there's any point where she says or sort of tries to practice or rehearse and sort of say, no, you can't come with me, you know, you have to stay here. Maybe no. But it's just the fact that he does what's easiest for him. And rather than going, you're my wife and I love you and it's I'm gonna come with you and we're a unit, we're a couple, we're together, we're one. I'm coming with you. And he kind of goes into it, and I was disappointed, I was angry, I was also kind of resigned to, well, of course he wasn't gonna go with her. But then that question of does it make us look at ourselves? Does it make us go, because it's very easy to go, well, I couldn't have done that. But when you again look at, okay, well, what are you
But
giving up?
would
What are
you?
you leaving behind? Would you know, he's very successful, he has this business, she's already talks about how he's losing business and things are going wrong for him, you know, financially.
But I think that's what the director got really well, was it was the husband that put the Jewish star on her at the end. And that's what I really, that is the moment that kind of broke me, was that this is a person who's meant to love you and is meant to support you and is meant to do anything for you till death do you part. He's actually having a part of this game to get rid of you. He is part of this problem, and I think that's what really upset me the most, really, to be honest.
And again, sort of circling back around to what you said about you think, you know, any young person who studies theatre or does drama should work with the play. What would you say is sort of the age range suitable for working with this?
I think for anyone who's studying Brecht, so kind of like A-level pupils upwards, I think it's a really accessible play for young people to look at each of the 24 plays as individual plays, and a reader, a student, a director, a teacher, whoever, could just take The Jewish Wife, or they can take Consulting the People, or The Old Militant. They can take any of these and actually dig deeper into it, as well as look at the whole play. So I think anyone from a kind of A-level point of view upwards who understands Brecht can get it. It definitely supports my ethos about Holocaust education and getting your young people to understand the complexities of the Holocaust. It wasn't just about Hitler, and it wasn't just about 6 million Jewish people. There was so much more to it. And
Preach. Yep.
yeah.
And also, just to do the international conversion rate for any American listeners, A level in the UK is about age 16 plus, 16,
Yeah, about
17
sixteen,
and
about
older.
sixteen. Yeah, about 16 onwards, I would say 16, because at that point you're kind of getting taught about Brecht and you're getting taught about Stanislavski and
And you'll also already, hopefully, have a solid foundation in Holocaust education as well.
yes, absolutely. Yep. So, and you've listened. Well, you've been taught a bit about about Nazi Germany and history, and you've got a bit of a kind of interest. But yeah, definitely, I would say in school it would be 16 plus. So,
And if there were any, I mean, I think you and I both like huge fans of this piece, and I think we've already covered all of the highlights of working with it and how incredibly valuable it is as a piece and just what can be done with it. What, if any, would you say are the challenges of working with Fear and Misery of the Third Reich?
I think the challenges is the fact that it's so complex. It's 24 scenes that gives us an insight into life in Germany at a very difficult moment in time. And it is up to the director, the teacher, the reader to make sure they understand each of the scenes. And the impact on the characters, the paranoid parents, the poor mother, the Jewish wife, the scientists. Yeah, it's there's just there's the there's just so much to it, that it's not something that can be studied in a week or 2 weeks.
Any final thoughts
So
on
I don't have a final thought, but I do want to say, so I can imagine to you this when we were chatting. So I'm a huge sci-fi fan as well. I'm getting very animated now. So
Uh-oh.
basically, for some of your listeners, you will know that there was a sci-fi program in the 1980s called V, which was about aliens that came down to Earth. They came as friends, but they actually were kind of reptiles underneath. And it was like a huge hit for like TV. It was like massive. So
Okay.
very kind of famous scene where the evil Diana eats a gerbil or something like that. Again, I think it was. So I was watching it again because I was a huge fan. And I was like, this is really similar to Fear and Misery of the Third Reich. And I was like, am I making this up? Like, I know I'm like obsessed by like V, but I'm also obsessed by Fear and Misery. Am I just like linking this together? And I thought, no. I was like, you had a Jewish family who were really paranoid because their son had joined the visitors' youth. And the mother was like, you can't say this to him, he's going to tell on us.
Okay.
Then you had Juliet Parrish, who was a scientist, who then had to split up with her boyfriend because he was a real estate person. And there was a whole paranoia thing about scientists because they were going to find out about the aliens. And she was like, no, I'm going to break up with you because people are not going to your business anymore because they know you're married to a scientist. And I was just like, this is
Hang
like the
on,
Jewish
yeah,
wife.
wait a
Like,
minute.
what is going on
What?
here? So I actually did some research, and yes, V was based off Fear and Misery of the Third Reich. So I was just like, how weird is this? So it was an inspiration for an Emmy award-winning sci-fi TV program in the 1980s called V. So that's my final about aliens coming down to Earth. That was my final thought. Okay,
I
but
will take things I would never have guessed for
yeah,
500, please, Alex.
you're going to have to watch it because the aliens uniform is
Oh,
red
don't
and
tell me
black.
they goosed. Oh, God.
No,
Okay.
it's red. It's like red and black, so it's like this the swastika. They have like a Hitler Youth program. It's called Visitors Youth. It's very symbolic to kind of like the Holocaust and like the Nazis and stuff. But yeah, I was really taken aback when I found out that V was based on Freedom of the Third Reich. So.
I mean, that also takes Lebensraum to a whole new level.
Absolutely. I was like, what would Brexit say about this? But they're not here.
I mean, oh, that is, best pun ever, alienation effect. You're welcome. You're all
absolutely,
weird.
absolutely. Give that to you. Yeah. Give that girl a coconut.
I thank
Yeah.
you to the face. John, it has been lovely having you. Thank you
I've
so
loved
much.
it. Thank you so much.
And yeah, so are you gonna come back for
Absolutely. Do you know
another
what?
one?
I was
Yay!
actually I was actually so like so nervous about this because
Bless you.
like you're Dr. Sam. So I was just like, what am I going to say that Sam doesn't already know? But I've absolutely loved it. So thank you so
Oh, I've loved
much.
having you. And
So
yes, so Alex will, so we're going to hold you to that promise and come back and you can talk to Alex and I,
oh, I would love that.
because I think the two of you together is going to be amazing. I'll just sit back and let you guys talk. It'll be fantastic. So thank you,
No,
listeners,
thank you
thank
so
you very
much.
much for joining us. Alex will be back on the next episode. So that is all from us for today. Till next time, take care. Be kind, look after each other, drink water,
Absolutely.
and yeah, we'll see you soon. Bye now.
Bye.